She was 27 years old when she did it. So let's officially start straight ahead. And here we are on a beautiful, cold Monday night in Los Angeles. And this is Straight Ahead. It's Monday night. It's Monday night here in Los Angeles. Tuesday morning, what is it about? And I can't believe where I'm actually starting on time. And I'm Hassan, KillRadio.org. Give us a call, 213-413-8004. And we lost Alice Coltrane last week. But for any those of you listening, there is going to be a memorial service for her up in Canyon Country. I heard earlier today there's going to be a memorial for Alice Coltrane up in Canyon Country this Saturday at her ashram. So let's all get on the 5 freeway and go up there and talk to her and John in the spiritual universe. So this show we're listening to is tonight dedicated to Alice Coltrane. I brought in some vinyl that I've had all my life with Pharoah Saunders, Cecil McBee, Charlie Hayden. All the old jazz bows are on these two albums with Miss Alice Coltrane. But we still got some Coltranes left. There's two sons. Unfortunately, one of the sons had died in a car crash about 10 years ago. There was a band called the Sons of John Coltrane. But there's still two more left, and there'll probably be a lot more Coltranes. So what we're going to do, we're going to put on that great album, Journey to Satchidananda, with Alice Coltrane and Pharoah Saunders. And let me see if I can bring it up in the background. And again, this is KillRadio.org. Oh yeah, there you go. I hear Alice on her harp. And this is the classic album, Journey to Satchidananda, with Mr. Pharoah Saunders. And I'll read the liner notes while this is going. I'll tell you who the rest of the people are. And then in between this, we're going to listen to a great interview that I got last week on Horace Tapscott, the great Los Angeles jazz musician who had the he started the Pan-African People's Liberation Orchestra. The only reason why it didn't get that much publicity because it was going on around the same time that Sun Ra's orchestra was going on. And Horace Tapscott and Sun Ra were great friends. So in between some of the Alice Coltrane cuts, you're going to hear this great interview about Mr. Horace Tapscott and the Pan-African People's Liberation Orchestra. And a big shout out to Mr. Mike Watt, because I know he's a big Alice Coltrane fan. I know you're out there on the road somewhere with the Stooges, Mike. But this is, as we got Alice Coltrane on in the background, let's pot up on this. Thank you. Yes. Hey. Kill Radio again, and you were listening to Journey to Satchitananda. That was Journey to Satchitananda by Miss Alice Coltrane. And I'm trying to bring up this interview right now on the orchestra. And again, looks like we're having
community life.
Oh, okay, here we go.
Along Central Avenue. It was block after block. It stretched from downtown Los Angeles down to Slauson by the late 30s. Then it jumped about 40 blocks of certain militantly defended white housing to the Watts area, which was a much more mixed community. But block after block along the Central Avenue in the black community, it was businesses, shops, and clubs, performance spaces, theaters. And it was this very vigorous social life. And you could wander block to block, club to club, place to place. If you were an aspiring musician, there was so much to draw upon. There was a black local of the American Federation of Musicians, which really was a social center. And young people like Horace Tapscott and Frank Morgan and Don Cherry and others who were to found the Pan-African People's Orchestra later on with Horace were on the steps of this union hall meeting all the elders, all the great musicians who would invariably come by even if they were just passing through town. Plus, there was quite a bit of music education within the community. There were great music programs in the schools at Jefferson High School and at Jordan High School in Watts. There were an array of private teachers teaching classical as well as jazz-oriented music. And, of course, the very vigorous church scene as well, musically. So there was so much to draw upon. And Horace was raised in the middle of this, and he always appreciated it. From a very, very early age, he appreciated the wealth of talent, the commitment of older artists to training younger artists, and he imbibed all of this. And it shaped him not only musically. People like his teacher at Jefferson, Sam Brown, and another great teacher, Lloyd Reese, but also a number of musicians like Gerald Wilson, who really took him under their wing. And he really is shaped by, in a sense, that community. And he, musically, but he also derives from that a philosophy, an ethic, and to an extent, an aesthetic as well, that really is going to lead him in the early 60s to make a commitment himself to the African-American community of Los Angeles.
And in the book, you tell a story about Horace getting off the bus, basically, off of Lionel Hampton's bus. Tell that story and how that...
Yeah, it's a great story. When Horace first told me that in the early 90s, I smiled all the way back home after that interview session because I loved it. He says that when we were talking about his decision to get off the up jazz escalator in the jazz world, the commercial world, and to commit himself to the arts in his community and thereby hopefully raising the standard of life in his community. He says that by early 61, he had been with Lionel Hampton's band for about 2 years. He was playing trombone, but he was also playing some rehearsal piano. He was also doing some arranging. But with Hamp's band, which was a traveling touring band, he was experiencing, over that time, a lot of disillusionment with the state of music, of commercially driven music, and the demands upon it, and the way that one's art could suffer because of that, or be stifled. You couldn't develop. And he had also seen the African-American community, as he saw it in the 1950s, kind of losing the cohesion, losing the a lot of the positive aspects that he felt in his Central Avenue days. And he had, all of this came together for him in early 61 in February, when he had finished a gig with Hamp Span in Hollywood, and they were about to get back on the bus. He says it was early in the morning, 4 a.m. or whatever. And they were going to head off on the road again, I guess, heading back to the East Coast. And he says he got on the bus, sat down, got up, and walked off, and he waved goodbye to a bandmate of his and said, "That's it, brother, I've had it." And he walked home.
He walked down to South Central.
Walked back home to South Central with really a new purpose forming in his mind.
Let's talk about the evolution of these various organizations that Horace created, starting with the UGMA, which morphed into the UGMAA, and there was also the Pan-African People's Orchestra. How do all of those things relate?
Initially, Horace talks about this. They began as the Underground Musicians Association. He was bringing together, as he said, the outcats, the people whose music was different. The music they wanted to play didn't fit into the studios or most mainstream bands. And this is what he was bringing together, which isn't to say that it was necessarily all outside music, but they were different. He was looking for people who were different. So initially they were underground. They were presenting stuff that was not on the surface. So the interesting thing to me from the beginning is here you have someone who wants to bring music and the arts to the center of his community to help raise the level of life in a community. And he's doing it, and they're trying to do it with music that on the one hand is very challenging, is very outside. And that to me is an interesting ambition, because where you are trying to impact your community in a large way, playing for ordinary audiences in the streets and in parks, and yet you're playing the most challenging music. At the same time, artistically, you're fulfilling yourselves. You're making no concessions. It's not playing down to anyone. And that struggle, I think, is really quite extraordinary. And the faith that Horace always had that people would come and listen to this music, and they did. Plus, the range of their music covered the whole range of black music as well. So for a while, they considered themselves underground, and they were known as the Underground Musicians Association. By about, as near as I've been able to pinpoint, by about 67, 68, they're expanding tremendously. Many people, more people are coming around. The organization's growing. And Horace always wanted the movement to be a forum for all the arts, a way of artists in various media expressing themselves. So they had poets, there were visual artists, there were even martial artists doing martial arts improvisations, things like this. So Underground Musicians Association seemed limited. So by about 67, 68, they're calling themselves UGMA, but with another A, Underground Musicians and Artists Association. Then between about 70, 71, they go through a number of changes. They start calling themselves the Community Cultural Orchestra. A few months later, the Community Cultural Orchestra. And then finally in 71, they adopt the name that continues to the present day. They name the band the Pan-African People's Orchestra, and they have a larger organization that retains the UGMA acronym that will house not only the band but other aspects of their programs. And this, at this point, UGMA comes to stand for the Union of God's Musicians and Artists Ascension. So there is this evolution that reflects, I think, simply a movement from their more marginal underground position to, by the early 1970s, much of what they had been advocating in the early 60s was really on the surface with all of the political and social and cultural movements of the late 1960s. So they no longer saw themselves as so underground, and their orientation had changed. African studies were much more on the surface, and so they change the name of their organization with that.
Another one of the central figures is Linda Hill, who created the first UGMA house and subsequent houses. Talk about Linda Hill.
Oh, well, as I write in the book, if Horace was the patriarch, Linda was the matriarch. And the more I find out about Linda, the more I'm convinced she's just one of the grievously ignored individuals in the history. And in some ways, even more than Horace, was a driving force in the organization, because she's the one who was at the center. For about 20 years, they had communal houses, essentially. They began as Linda's house, and they called them UGMA houses. But they were spaces where a number of members, anywhere from 10 to 15, 20 members of the organization, would be living at any one time, where there would be nonstop music, revolving door, of all sorts of activity. And this went on for about 20 years. in different locations. And Linda was at the middle of all that. Very early on, she was one of the people, even before it became more fashionable, but in the early 60s, she was one of the few who was pursuing African cultural studies, who was attempting to dig more into the heritage and the history and pull out, you know, what was valuable and useful for them and what they were trying to do. So she was really a force in that sense, and one of the you know, along with Horace, co-essential figure in this movement. She was also someone who contributed musically.
Why are these mics so low? Why is this mic? Why are these mics so low? This is QLRadio.org. This show is called Straight Ahead. And this is the classic Alice Coltrane album. In the background, Journey to Satchitanata. And, you know, I think I've only played this album maybe once or twice in the 15, maybe 20 years I've had it. Alice looks so beautiful on the cover. And I told you I would read you the personnel on harp. In piano, we have Alice Coltrane, soprano saxophone, Pharoah Saunders, on timbala, Tulsi, on oud, Vishen Wood, on bass, Cecil McBee. Our other bass player is LA's own Charlie Hayden. Charlie's teaching up at CalArts right now. On drums, we have Rashid Ali, and on bells and tambourine, we have Majid Shabazz. And this is a classic Impulse. ABC Impulse album, Journey to Satchitanata, with Miss Alice Coltrane in the background. Oh my God, there goes Pharoah Saunders. And this show is called Straight Ahead, every Monday night, Tuesday morning. And I'm Hassan, and you're also hearing this great interview on Horace Tapscott, who, when you listen to the music that was coming out of South Central Los Angeles in the late 50s, 60s, you hear a lot of music that was influenced by Alice and John Coltrane. That's why I wanted to play this. Okay? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Another unsung figure would be Horace's wife, who I'm assuming must have brought in most of the bacon during all of those years.
Yeah, it was very, especially in the early years, a very hard time, because when you think of Horace's movement, as people say over and over in the book, this is something that they never got paychecks. This was purely from the heart and from the mind, wanting to fulfill themselves as artists as freely as possible. So there was very rarely a payday, even though they performed, especially at the height of these movements in the 60s and 70s, sometimes they'd be performing many days a week. It was very rare that they ever got a paycheck, and then it would be maybe if they played a college somewhere, or maybe if the musicians' union paid them to give a concert in South Central, then there might be a payday. But other than that, nothing. In fact, most of them say we never even thought about it. It never entered into the equation. Money never came up. One player, Rufus Olivier, told me that when he was with the band throughout the 70s, he doesn't even remember when we were talking, he said, you know, I don't even remember one time where the subject even came up. So it was hard, but especially for the older musicians who had families, what do? You find different ways to survive. Horace, he, with his contacts with Gerald Wilson and others, occasionally he would arrange things for studios. He arranged some, I think there was an old rock song in the 60, I think it was called Papa Umau Mau by the Rivingtons. Was there a Horace Tapscott arrangement? Not many people know that. Horace had arrangements with a couple of people in studios. He would do things like that. There were occasional gigs, pay gigs for small groups. But basically, these guys had to rely on their wives. It's an old story in jazz. Like in the book, Donald Dean tells the joke that went around, you know, what's homeless? It's a musician without a wife.
Exactly.
And that's how it was for a lot of these people. So Cecilia Tapscott was an anchor. She had a regular job at County Hospital as an administrator. That gave them an economic foundation. And then Horace would bring in whatever he could. And they had a big family. By the time when Horace started doing this, he had five kids, 61.
There seems to be a bit of animosity between Sun Ra and his orchestra and Horace and his orchestra.
No, there really wasn't. I kind of wish I had been able to shape that a bit different. There's one quote in the book, after they performed together, or on the same stage, after one, that might lead yourself to think that one of the former members of Horace's orchestra says, yeah, we smoked them that night. But that was only one person's remembrance of it. For the most part, Horace and Sun Ra were good friends. Whenever Ra was in town, whenever he was in town by himself or with a band, he was out over at Horace's place. And Horace told me, you never knew when they were going to turn up. He said one time they turned up at 2 or 3 in the morning, the whole band parked outside his house, and they all came tromping in. And then about 8 o'clock, they all left. One of them said, Ra, we got to get to San Francisco. So they took off.
And there was nothing negative about taking the name orchestra?
No, that never came up at all. It never came up. And Horace, in his autobiography, he always credited Sun Ra with being the first person to use that. But he also explained, too, how different they were. I mean, Sun Ra's vision of the orchestra was more as a solar vehicle traveling through the galaxies and things like this. And for Horace, his orchestra was really a cultural safe house. It was Noah's Ark as a reservoir of the history of black music and culture.
And how did it relate politically to the organizations like the Black Panthers and the US organization in L.A. at that time?
The amazing thing about Horace's band is, at one point, one of the musicians said, basically, we were the people's band. They played for and were involved with any organization in the community, religious, political, cultural, that they felt was contributing to the betterment, to the development of African Americans. So they performed. One of the members, drummer Bill Madison, said he remembers one day they played for the Panthers in the afternoon. They went and played for Black Democrats that night. So They were not a politically programmatic organization. They didn't have a party line. They didn't have a set of political principles that you pretty much would have to adhere to join. It wasn't like that at all, although individually they had strong political views. But the band itself was more like a family where you have a range of views and interests but are held together by something else, by a larger, in their sense, a purpose of uplifting the community. So they were in a lot of different political settings, and they didn't have a particular orientation. But if you were to sit down and probably poll the members, and if you were to look at the organizations they performed with the most and seemed to be more closely associated to, it was the Black Panthers.
Let's go back and talk a little bit about the musical style. When he first formed the Underground Musicians Association, the music was, in your words, very avant-garde. I haven't listened to a whole range of these recordings, so I'm not speaking from experience here. But from what I've heard in the recordings in the book, there are definitely avant-garde elements. But the use of ostinato and kind of riffing-based music brought the music more, quote-unquote, to the people. Yeah. Talk a little bit about the evolution. Did it become less avant-garde over the years?
It was not a situation, and it certainly wasn't in Horace's music, in his personal music also, but it wasn't a situation where they would be in any way equivalent, say, to someone like Cecil Taylor, whose music is consistently in one direction and who has really created his own world and a very outside sound. It wasn't like that. The band had a tremendous range. At one point, I list the kind of music that they had in their book at the time, and it is really a tremendous range. They did perform a lot of the range of Coltrane's music, McCoy Tyner's music, people like this. They performed also at times, they would do mass collective improvisations, which would be very outside as well. And this I've only heard from description.
No recordings.
No recordings. See, most of the things, there is really, considering the history of the band, the period of time we're talking about, there's very little that's available to hear. So that's one thing. And I don't have a strong enough sense of exactly how outside it was, because I haven't heard a lot of the collective improvisations. We may have some on some of the tapes in Horace's archive, which we're hoping to digitize in the near future. But given their age, et cetera, we didn't dare play them, especially stuff from the 60s. So for a lot of that, that's all I have. And from the recorded work that we have, which is not much for the orchestra as a whole, it is a much broader range of music. And there really isn't a particular style you can pinpoint. It's very eclectic. It's all over the place.
Listening to jazz historian Stephen Iswardi in conversation with web producer Richard Paskey.
In a sense, then, I think you can't identify the band in the way you can identify, say, Cecil Taylor as having a particular kind of sound. The band was much more broad, much more eclectic. In a sense, I think it's partly a reflection. Even though a lot of Horace's music and some of his playing, he can get very outside. There is a much broader range in the band, from very traditional stuff, from spirituals, from gospel, to the full range of African-American music. And even in the few albums we have of the orchestra, and three albums were recorded commercially in the late 70s, early 60s for a small label, there is a range of writing on the band that really does not enable you to find a center or a direction to it. And I think it was because Horace... It's very interesting. He didn't impose his conception on the band. Sun Ra's band was Sun Ra's band. It was a band that existed to further his worldview. The interesting thing about Horace's is, in a sense, it was not. To Horace, I think, it was supposed to be a community movement. The band was supposed to reflect the arts in the community. And when people would come into the band, they would be exposed to his music and that of others. But he always encouraged people to write what they were hearing and they were feeling. And so the range of the music was very varied. And in fact, on those albums that came out, there's only one piece of Horace's on all the cuts on those four albums. So there was a sense then that the band did play the range of music. It played the range of music that was available within the community. Horace himself, I think it's hard to say, to describe him even as outside. I think Horace is someone where inside and outside loses the ability to really capture some of the music because he combined them. There was an organic quality to his music where he might begin an inside piece or a traditional bop standard, take it very outside and come back, and it would all seem to fit. It would all seem to be organic. As Wayne Pete says in the book, you wouldn't sit there and ask yourself, well, why is he doing that? Or why is he going outside now in the middle of Now's the Time or something like this? It would always seem very developmental, as out as it got in some cases. And then he'd bring it back. But that was Horace's style. And that was always, I think, if anything, that characterizes music and building these unique kind of extensions off these dark ostinati that you referred to, which is a hallmark of Horace's. And for Horace, that went back to African tradition, to drums, which he says is the sound that had been with him through his entire life. So in a way, it can be frustrating. It'd be nice to pigeonhole the orchestra, as you can talk about Sun Ra's. Although, in a sense, if you look at Sun Ra, he played a great range of music as well.
Absolutely.
Right. But I think with Horace's, it's even greater. But I think it's a reflection of his commitment to pulling as many different sounds as he could from the community and not imposing his view directly on the band. I think he realized that this was going to be a community orchestra. He had to reflect. Thank you.
and starting with stylistically and then moving to the social. I went to the Limerick Park Jazz Festival this year a couple weeks ago, and while the music was performed very, very well, most of it, with the exception of a bass quintet, most of it I would categorize as being extremely mainstream inside music. So I'm wondering...
Except maybe Azar Lawrence.
I maybe left before...
Afro blue solo.
maybe, but in general, that was not music that I would consider avant-garde in any sense.
Right.
So has the legacy that Horace might have engendered kind of dissipated? Musically, stylistically?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think to a degree it has. I think, just as I think the community arts now are experiencing some very rough times as well. Part of the force of the 90s is gone. Rising real estate is driving artists out. I mean, there are a lot of finding opportunities to perform. All of these things are creating some serious, serious problems now. I think the music was also a reflection of the times. The avant-garde, the out music of the 60s and the 70s, and I think a lot of the force driving that has dissipated. We're living in horribly uninteresting, in some ways, uninspiring times. And I think that's had a tremendous impact in dampening. I don't know that it has prevented creativity, but in terms of gaining exposure for those artists who are trying to do work that is different, I think it's hard to find the opportunities to perform before any kind of a significant audience. And it's interesting, too, I think in looking at Horace's leadership, I think he pulled music out of people that they didn't even know they had. And I know people sound different, people who played with Horace, and then you see them away from Horace, and there's a difference. I won't say better or worse, but there is clearly a difference. And I think a leader like Horace pushes people to the boundaries more, to take more chances. And so I think him not being around has had a bit of an impact that way as well. But I think you also have to be careful in evaluating festivals of any kind in any place. Because especially these days, people tend to be more conservative, and they aren't going to book the more challenging acts and the more challenging artists.
Perhaps that mantle has been taken up by the rap and hip-hop artists, though.
I think to a degree, definitely, no question. And I think even in terms of the community movement, I think one of the legacies, if you will, not simply of Horace, but I think the whole community arts thing is one of the defining characteristics of the African-American community of Los Angeles, going back to the Central Avenue days. It's one of the things, to my mind, that just stands out throughout the 20th century. And I think one of the inheritors of that tradition today is Project Bloed down in Limerick Park. Project Bloed functions in a space on Thursday nights in a space called Chaos, run by Ben Caldwell. And it's, I think, one of the most interesting rap scenes in the country. You could call it underground, or you call it community rap scenes. It's led by people like AC Alone and others from the Freestyle Fellowship, as well as a number of other wonderful artists who have really been part of that community going back before Project Bloed, which began in 94 in Limerick, but before that they hung out at a place called The Good Life and things like this. And I think they've been carrying on a lot of that ethos and that tradition. And in fact, when things were really popping down in Limerick, Horace would frequently play at the World Stage and then walk around the corner on Thursday nights to Project Bloed.
And check them out.
Check them out. See what was going on. And they respected him. One night, one of the rappers started going, and they saw Horace walk in. Hey, there's an elder in the house. And they really respected him. In fact, on the Freestyle Fellowship's recording session for their Inner City Griot release on Islands in the early 90s, they had Horace in those sessions, and he played piano on a couple of tunes. They weren't released on that CD, but they were subsequently released on two other CDs, a couple of things that he played on. So there was enormous respect. And in fact, one of the important groups that gave rise, in a sense, to rap in L.A. was the Watts Prophets, who go back to the 60s with Horace and others. And those three poets, one of them, Father Amdi, credits Horace with sort of hipping him the importance of rap. I mean, now the Watts Prophets are honored as godfathers of rap. But Father Amdi said it was Horace who really hipped into it. And he said, you know, these kids, I mean, people complain they're not, they've left the blues, they don't play the blues anymore. And Horace always said, but they are, they're creating their own blues. That's what rap is.
And perhaps that's the social legacy as well.
Most definitely, most definitely. And I think those guys have enormous appreciation of Horace and what he did in his legacy, and Horace loved them.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for being my guest on Zocalo. It's been fascinating talking with you about this really great moment in Los Angeles history and in jazz history.
Thank you. I think it is, too. I think it really is precious. I've been a fan for a long time, and it's nice to get the voices. I think I've always been a fan of oral history. My favorite books have been oral histories, especially with jazz. And I think to present more of the words of some of these people is quite wonderful. I hope people will just be hip to them. Go out and listen to him.
My guest has been Stephen Iswardi. He's a teacher at the Oakwood School and the author of The Dark Tree, Jazz and the Community Arts in Los Angeles, published by the University of California Press in 2006. You've been listening.
Okay, everybody, this is going to be a short show tonight because I got to get up and go to work in about 9 hours. 7 hours. I got to have my coffee before I go to work. But this show's been dedicated to Miss Alice Coltrane. The first album we heard was Journey to Sacha Donata with Pharoah Saunders. This one we're listening to right now is the Al Dodd with Joe Henderson. And Joe Henderson's on this one. We're only going to hear this first cut, which is it's called the Al Dodd. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. D-A-O-U-D. The Al Dodd. Alice Coltrane. She passed away last week. So she's with John now. And this show is called Straight Ahead every Monday night, Tuesday morning on KeelRadio.org. And we're going to go out right now. I'm going to have to end the show because I got to get out of the studio, go out into this beautiful, cold Los Angeles night. Email me, HassanJ53@yahoo.com. That's Hassan, H-A-S-S-A-N. Okay? And again, it's Straight Ahead every Monday night. Every Monday night at midnight. Hassan, H-A-S-S-A-N, HassanJ53@yahoo.com. And I can't make that many live shows these days, you guys, because I got to work. I'm doing about maybe 2 shows a month. But we have a lot of archives. A lot of my stuff was on radioforall.net. You can hear a lot of my stuff there. So thanks for listening. And I'm going to try and get back here, if not next week, definitely week after next. Again, this is KeelRadio.org. Let's go out with this is all vinyl you're hearing, too. This is Alice Coltrane in the background. Alice on piano.